Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Diane Beekhuizen, founder and CEO of Shoshanworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. In this series, brought to you by Shoshanworks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, we're exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And over the next three episodes, we're investigating the exciting and expanded role that space plays in shaping the future of our planet and the human experience. In this episode, we'll explore the threats, challenges, and opportunities that are necessitating the growth of the space economy. What activated our history of space exploration, and why is it accelerating now? What role does space play in planning for the future of humanity? We're extremely fortunate to be joined today by two of the world's leading futurists in aerospace and the space economy. I couldn't be more pleased to introduce Vikram Shyam as my co-host today. Vic, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Dan. Hey, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for about 15 years, and I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. Got a background in propulsion, biomimicry, and foresight, and looking forward to getting back into it.
Excellent. And everyone, again, joining us today is Isaac Arthur, President, National Space Society Futurist, and host of the popular YouTube channel Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur. Welcome, Isaac.
Thank you so much for having me on, Diane, Vic. It's great to continue our conversation.
Thrilled. We could talk to you forever, Isaac. So why don't we start today's discussion with a few of your thoughts on the role that space may play in our future? And can you maybe share your thoughts on some of the trends, patterns, and indications of where space is headed?
I think the biggest thing we're seeing where space is heading in the near future is essentially the idea that we're going to need to start doing more ISRU for almost anything we do. It's amazing how much we're getting done with reusable rockets these days. And in some ways, that's made us a little bit overconfident about how much more progress we can make without actually doing more ISRU on places like the moon. But obviously, in the long term, that helps us do the build up to greater projects in space. So if I had to guess what the big paradigm is going to be probably in the next decade, it probably would be how do we do resource extraction in a post-Artemis environment when we have that mission accomplished and say, what's next step?
And I guess, Isaac, you might want to spell out ISRU for the audience.
Oh, I'm sorry. In situ resource utilization. The idea that if I'm on the moon, I get most of my materials, not all of them, but most of them that way. And especially with space, you can manufacture a microchip here on Earth and send it into space indefinitely. They are worth more than their weight in gold. And it's already cheap enough to go bring gold home from the moon. The fuel doesn't cost that much. But for a lot of things, we just need raw oxygen, for instance, which is most of the weight of space fuel is the oxidizer. These are things where we definitely want to be doing that on the moon. Radiation shielding, we'd want to be able to do that on the moon, where it's very easy to get access to and easy to pull it off. So lunar resource extraction is one of those big ones we've been looking at, or ISRU, in situ resource utilization.
Thanks, Isaac. Hey, and towards the end of the last podcast, speaking of ISRU and resources in space and such, we were talking about going beyond the traditional scientific exploration, right, and building social structures and economic system, governance, security, and such. So what do you think the practical implications are when we're thinking about these kinds of, like, setting up lunar colonies and Martian colonies and space exploration? These seem to be increasingly in reach. So what do you think about the social systems in that context?
One of the things I always like to remind on cases like this, we see so much science fiction where on this pioneer colony on Mars, people go ahead and they set up a new government, and it's Mars versus Earth or Moon versus Earth. And say, this is a colony of 10,000 people. How many people do they have who are lawyers? How many doctors do they have? Who's running their court of appeals? Do they have one? Do they have a Supreme Court? Who's doing their judicial review? Who's the professor of law, for instance? So it's just those legal ones. Say, well, why don't we afford that home? They say, instead of being a new nation, maybe you're not a new country, but just a new county. And so you start the Armstrong Country on the Moon nation, or the Armstrong Township in the Shackleton Cradle County of Canada, whichever province of Canada, if they have Canada, if counties, I'm not sure. But there's other aspects of these cultures that will be popping up. We assume they're going to be very open, independent, free-minded folks, because that's all kind of all idealized view of either space astronauts or space cowboys or cowboys. And there was some truth to that, but I think that we'll probably see it much more structural this time because we have instant communication. Even to a place like Mars, yes, it takes 20 minutes to get there, but that's just email time, not phone time. Most of the time throughout history, nations have run on the nearest town was an hour's communication away, and the frontier was weeks. So anywhere in the solar system, you still got effectively instant communication, one day tops. The other aspect is we talk about space colonization, and people say, well, should we be looking at solving the problems here on Earth as opposed to in space? And of course, we all say, well, we can walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. Many of these solutions present solutions back home, too. One of the ones that we'll hear is, well, we need to do space habitats and colonies so we can lower the population here on Earth and fix the place and bring back nature and its prestige. I say, I don't know that's necessarily the right approach. Maybe you're not building a space habitat for people. Maybe you're building a space habitat as a nature preserve, because it's hard to get a more closed system than that. It's very hard to, you build an O'Neill cell, a big space habitat in the vacuum of space. That's just a county-sized object full of nature preserve, one biome. No one's hiking in there without permission. No one is accidentally having some random organism invade invasively through like rats or bunnies to Australia. And so in some ways, those might be better options. You do giant nature preserves in space. There are so many options in space. I think we were saying last time that the key of space is that we have three ways of looking at space colonization. We have those things that we can only do in space. We have those things we'd rather do in space, which a nature preserve might turn out to be one of, rather than trying to do it here on Earth, where the land values might be much higher than actually building a space habitat at some point. And then we have those things we just do because space has so much of it. Folks who might be familiar with the idea of a Dyson swarm or something along those lines would say the far more distant aspects of space is you could build millions of times Earth's living area in terms of space habitats. And say, well, even if only 1% of those was given over just to nature preserves, that means that you have 10,000 Earth's worth of nature preserves. You know, these are the kind of amazing options you have at scale in space, as well as any number of just things you could never do on Earth. You could have that environment where gravity is only 50% of what it is on Earth, and that's the place everyone likes to go for holidays, to go skiing at, and things like this. So there's just so many options up there that it's hard not to think of why we shouldn't go.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And if we think about that, I've spent decades working in new market development arenas, right? And there's typically kind of a general sequencing when you're opening up new markets. So if we look at the history, if you will, of Earth-based market development cycles, generally speaking, to your point, infrastructure like legal, financial, and communication systems typically need to be in place and somewhat mature before the rest of kind of the development process will begin to invest, right? So you need that infrastructure in place before other mainstream investment starts to come along. So if I'm a business leader today in an industry that doesn't currently have a strong connection to space or an obvious connection to space, should I be paying attention to space-enabled futures? And what are some of the practical use cases or scenarios that might touch non-space sectors? And can you give us some practical examples of who should have space on their radar? See what I did there and why?
I'll give the unsurprising answer is that it's everybody. And for your point for infrastructure, one thing we found out from the Wild West, as an example, is that if you don't put that infrastructure in place, it will organically arise, and organically often means that there ain't much difference between the law enforcement and the local robber baron. And we want to make sure we put these things in from the get-go, because so much of our growing pains as civilization comes from not taking the time to put those foundations in place. And it's not as sexy to have a space lawyer. My immediate predecessor as the National Space Society president, Michelle Hanlon, space law is her area. And she's done amazing things getting that moving as a serious topic. It really wasn't even a couple of decades ago, besides maybe satellites. And yet it's so important. Space medicine is so important. One of my friends studies how lighting and sound affect us. We get a lot of information out of the space station about that, for instance, in terms of our sleep. And that benefits us down here, too. Is so important for helping to find these. And those are all those little opportunities that say, I'm in this area. Is there a role for my business sector in space? Yes. Yes, and sooner than later. Right? Maybe today is not the day that you want to go ahead and start manufacturing your ball bearings in space, but that might be one of those things that happens because microgravity is great for that. The hospitality industry will be a big one going there. And say, could space survive on hospitality alone? Well, if it gets cheap enough, yes, absolutely. Think about how many people spend how much money on hotels per year. It's a huge economic sector. All these things, they are going to be like any new area, a lot of losses, a lot of badly planned out forced failures, but this is the nature of all the investment is get in while the market is barely formed, and that's when you're going to get your best results and profits. So it is a risk still. I'm not going to tell people this is the day to dump $1 trillion into research and development space, but it is the time to really start seriously looking to see where those avenues are. Put this as a reminder on that is one of the most important things for a successful business in this modern economy is attracting talent that wants to do the work and stay. One of the things the National Space Society sees itself as doing, one of the things I personally see myself as doing with the show, is feeding that STEM pipeline, is making sure that those brilliant young minds who have the enthusiasm find something to be enthusiastic about. And if you want your company to successfully grow on this planet, be ready to start considering which numbers of your employees would love to be working on getting off this planet too.
The talent that you're talking about, you're thinking about them as physically traveling to space as well, or are you thinking about some kind of using the communication that's available?
One day. I mean, you could do a lot of telepresence stuff, and in the near future, that's going to be a good deal more of it. Most folks who work in the space industry have never left this planet, and never will. I myself do not really like the idea of personally going to space, because I'm a little bit afraid of heights, but it's where my brain lives, and it's where a lot of people's hearts and minds live, and it is where potentially the civilization is eventually going to live, but that is certainly a long ways off. Whether or not your business is taking advantage of those space opportunities, though, yeah, you always have to keep in mind that aspect of, for all those people whose hearts and minds want to live in space, they're going to be happy to still live on the ground and work for you locally, but they need that room to spread their wings, metaphorically, if not physically.
Well, I was just listening to both of you, wondering how much AR and VR plays as a virtual bridge, right? To start to blur the boundaries between kind of the physical space and the terrestrial space. Does AR and VR play strongly in those pathways, both for earning and learning, right? Commercially and from an educational perspective, does that start to bridge the experiences for us?
Anything that's more experiential, absolutely. The more interactive it is, the more, you know, a book is pure text, and yet we learn from those very well. And we sometimes knock television-based learning, but since that's kind of what I do on YouTube, I would say that it's very effective compared to reading a text in a lot of cases in terms of engagement. That experiential approach to learning, to building knowledge, enthusiasm, and a feeling of it being real, you don't have to actually go step on the moon to learn so much about it. And a virtual reality program is clearly one of those ways that you would do that very well, an augmented reality one. And this is going to be true of so many industrial sectors too. So, you know, what gets people interested in learning about this topic, always better if it's experiential. Training, always better that way too. We'd love to be able to train our astronauts that way. It obviously has huge, anything hands-on, military training, basic traits and crafts, I'd say that is definitely one of those non-space related things, is how do I start doing hands-on skills with augmented reality for training? Those are going to be huge areas and markets to explore. And there's an example of how do you get the talent to come work for your company that builds learning programs. Well, they may not be too enthused about building the welding program for basic welding of cars, but they probably love to put together the side mod that does the welding of a spacecraft on the moon. These are opportunities. They're small things. You have to look for them, though. And the coolest thing about that talent is if that's where their enthusiasm is, you won't have to look. You just have to give them permission to look. They'll find it. And then you say, we'll figure out a way to make this profitable, at least break even. Put your enthusiasm there, and the knock-on effect will definitely profit us. We have your talent here. That's where we're going to keep you. And that's the big factor there, I'd say. But VR and AR and learning, absolutely. Absolutely.
Another tech-related question, Isaac. So let's say that the short term, a lot of the communication is through telepresence, let's say VR, AR. The people who are going out to space, let's say lunar colonies, Martian colonies, whatever it is we set up, they're going to be isolated for some time, presumably. And is there a risk there in terms of, it's going to take a long time, maybe 100,000 years for species divergence, obviously, but in terms of the physiological changes that happen to populations, and then potentially culture shock that may happen once transport is followed. And related to transport, is there a role for aviation and aviation-like activities when these colonies get set up, when these space-based platforms get set up, and what do you see in terms of opportunities there?
Say, what strange new branches of humanity might grow up on alien, strange new worlds under alien suns? I mean, there will be massive divergence even before the physiological kicks in. Your whole life has been on the moon where you're sitting there on the brightest thing in your sky. Either you've never seen the Earth because you're on the one side of the moon, or every day it's right there in the sky all day long, big as the sun. Bigger than the sun. And that's going to change your worldview of things, especially since you're not on this world. In terms of, you know, travel these places, I think there would be tourism on Mars, but your biggest tourism is going to be, do you want to be a pilot? Yes, but it's so much cheaper to grab Microsoft Flight Simulator and play that, and it gets good. And these things are getting better. And that has the effect of, people are always worried in entertainment or tourism, if we were to do things, even just like postcards, they might not come. This, hard to believe, back when postcards were due, people were worried that if you send a photograph of this monument around very easily to people, they wouldn't want to come see the real thing because they could just look at the picture. Now we know that just feeds it. People say, well, I've seen it. Now I'm going to go there, touch it, feel it. Not everyone, so we're satisfied with that. Think of space the same way. You probably could never afford to go on a trip to Mars, but you certainly could enjoy the AR, VR version of it, the one that you could develop as part of your training program for those first astronauts. Same for telepresence. We have these options for not just the moon, but for deep sea oil drilling, things like that, any number of underwater explorations. This is where telepresence is going to come in great, or even for something like surgery. We know how important that role could be. These are our options. These are the new additional means of getting things done. So they're not going to be the change of one way or another as whether or not we do it. They're just going to be part of the method by which we do it. You'll have VR and telepresence in every aspect of life, and certainly in the space world.
So I'm thinking in terms of, so you're talking about people traveling and maybe getting things. What about things like the supply chain and infrastructure and building? I'm thinking of something like Ingenuity, a scientific purpose, but going beyond that to supporting the people that are over there. Do you see that being aerial, or do you see it largely being ground-based with like supply ships and such?
That's a tricky one because it's going to depend on the environment. Like on the moon, I was talking with Pascal Lee a couple months back, and he was pointing out just how hard it was with the basic rover designs we have to actually go over this or that crater rim wall to get the ice that's right on the other side of it. So that it made much worse paths than we thought. But again, aerial travel not so good on the moon, but you can maybe do little leapfrogs. It's hard to say. Tethers, little roadways, things that are not possible on Earth becomes way easier in different environments. Place like Venus, rigid airships are just the best way to go, as it were. Those options become too specific to the environment for us to really standardize it. But you see them for like asteroids. All the asteroids are going to be about the same. And they are just going to be resupplied by whatever slow boat most wants to get there and give them whatever trade item they got in exchange for ore. It'll be a marginal business, probably. Those things for how we would actually do Mars, for instance, could be very tricky. And people have explored those in detail. And I'm glad they did because it paints a thicker picture. But the reality is the information's not yet there, in my opinion, to really be able to say it's going to be A, B, or C. Do you need to have that industrial chain between these places, though? Because it's always going to be a little bit cheaper to do something here than there, or there than here, excepting probably stellar space travel. But even there, it's going to be cheaper to do research on Earth and send it to those colonies. And I don't know what they pay in yet, but maybe they pay in having set themselves up. But while you have that in play, whether it's the trade in data and information, which can go at light speed, and thus is always going to be practical inside the solar system, or whether it's other neat ideas that might be good trade locally versus here or there, we want that trade to happen because it's a stabilizing influence. It allows you to send people back and forth voluntarily so they don't get too holed up and insular, and they still feel like they need to be part of the wider ecosystem. So we would want, even if you had to subsidize, I'd say it'd be worth it, but I don't think you'll have to for very long. I suspect it will be the subsidy for everything else before very long, that it will be your huge economic opportunity. It may need some initial encouragement, but I don't think we need too much.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And listening to you both, if there ever was a case for thoughtful ecosystemic design, intelligence, and orchestration. This is it, right? Because as the different factors and destinations become more and more clear and plausible, investments will flow in, but they need to, there are interdependencies, right, that need to play in for those investments to be successful, right? So you need the ecosystem to share a vision, right, and the different components or constellations of that ecosystem need to come online and mature in a way that the other components can be successful.
That trust that you can actually invest in that area with a certain reliability, that area is not going to be radically shifted or dumped over the next year. That's the biggest part. You need to know that there's a chance for stability.
Yeah. Trust is, we find in ecosystemic models, trust is often a currency in those networks, right? You need to have a fair understanding and a sense of trust that at least your investment or your contribution in is going to return some level of benefit. So that's kind of my key takeaway from this conversation, Vic. Some of your key takeaways from this conversation and really the conversations that have preceded as well.
I actually like the idea of the biopreserve, Isaac. I hadn't heard of that one before in space. You know, we've talked about doing something like that on Earth, where you have these zones that you keep pristine. But yeah, to your point, much easier in space. And the point about these opportunities that we need to look for that maybe are high risk and very niche. So that's something we should definitely be looking out for. Appreciate your thoughts, Isaac.
I was very glad to give him this great conversation today. And I would say, again, just the final thought for me on the matter is the biggest thing we have going about space, its biggest advantage, its biggest promise is that it is so huge. And if we trust ourselves and our better minds, better ethics to kind of proceed forward and take advantage of these opportunities, there is so much for everyone out there. It is just a boundless opportunity, and it is worth the time. It is worth the investment, and it is something that will be both a label of love and profit. So I encourage everyone to give space a second thought or even fourth look and just start dreaming up ways to go explore the heavens above.
I couldn't agree more. And Isaac, thank you. I'll echo Vic's thoughts. Thank you so much for sharing really this fascinating insight into both the risks and the abundance of space-enabled futures, and for helping to kind of shine a bright light on the path forward. So for our listeners, if you just joined us for this episode, please do make sure to catch up on the two previous conversations with Isaac Arthur, where we explore the challenges that are driving the flight to space and the potential futures for industry, society, and humanity that space could unlock. And join us too for our next Ecosystemic Futures podcast series brought to you by Shoshanworks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, where we'll continue to explore topics with world-class experts who are leading in the arenas of foresight, development, and design for greater ecosystemic resilience. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And as always, you can learn more at shoshanworks.com. Thank you, everyone.